Hi, this is Rabbi Jeffrey Sachs again of Web Yeshiva and Atid. A new semester, but continuing with our discussion of the Rambam's Shmona Prakim, his eight chapters. I'll give you a quick intro on what that means. If you're listening to this in the archive recordings or on an MP3, please visit www.webyeshiva.org for our full array of online interactive classes and shiurim on an array of Jewish studies. So just again, a quick review for those of you for whom this is new. The Rambam, Maimonides, the great eagle, as he is known, for reasons that have never been completely clear to me. The Rambam lives 1135 to 1205. As a student of mine when I taught high school once said, for only half an hour? No, the great figure of the 12th century, born in Spain, flees Spain at a young age, at around the age of Bar Mitzvah, due to the Almohad persecutions and invasion of Spain, spends a bit of time wandering, probably through northern Africa, shows up in Cairo, in Fustat, in what's today modern Cairo, where he rises to glory in the Jewish community, in the general court of the Sultan, where he serves as the court physician, and parallel to that he serves as a dayan, a judge, and the head of the Jewish community, which was then, of course, a very major Jewish community in Cairo. He is known as a great, first and foremost, of course, a pillar of the halachic literature, the first among equals, perhaps, amongst the Rishonim, amongst the scholars that live, for a period of time from around the year 1000 to around the year 1500. His work, the Mishneh Torah, the Yad HaChazakah, his Encyclopedia of Halacha in 14 volumes, is the indisputable masterpiece of halachic literature of the period, notable for its inclusion side by side with its obvious halachic nature, philosophical components as well. Also, of course, known for the famous work that he publishes later in life, the Moreh Nevuchim, the Guide for the Perplexed. His monumental attempt to synthesize Jewish philosophy and Aristotelian philosophy, if not synthesize, then to minimize conflict, to show the Jewish approach to a variety of philosophical questions that were very much pressing in the ancient world, and then even, of course, in the medieval world when he lived. Someone recently pointed out to me, a great teacher here in Israel, pointed out to me one of the Rambam's major points of agenda in the Moreh Nevuchim was to debate Aristotle on the question of the eternality of the world. Aristotle thought that the world had existed forever, that it had not been created, but that it always was. The Rambam, of course, thought that the world was indeed created at a fixed point in time by a creator, none other than God. No one believes this anymore. No one believes the Aristotelian. Yes, Aristotle, Brian. He was in dialogue with. Of course, Aristotle lived many hundreds of years beforehand, but he's in dialogue with the Aristotelian school of philosophy, not with Aristotle himself. No one, of course, believes anymore that the world had existed forever. There are, of course, debates about evolution and creationism and the Big Bang versus God or a creator. Those are different discussions. But nobody believes this Aristotelian idea that the Rambam was arguing against, that the world had always existed. So someone pointed out to me, it's worth studying these ideas of Aristotle, which are no longer a threat, which are no longer relevant because they've been completely rejected, but it's worth understanding them just to understand how the Rambam then goes about dissecting them. I thought that was an interesting comment. But perhaps less known than these works, and again, this is by way of review for those of you that have been with us for the earlier rounds of this series. Pardon me. Less well known, but also of great significance, is the Rambam's commentary on the Mishnah. No, I'm sorry, Brian. I hope you didn't misunderstand me. That's Aristotle's point. The Rambam disagrees with that. The Rambam thinks that, of course, the world was created ex nihilo, yesh mi'ayin, from scratch, as it were, by God. And he's arguing against the position that the universe was always present for eternity, retroactively. The commentary on the Mishnah, which was the work of his youth, he completed it around the age of 30. Is a commentary on the Mishnah, the great work of the Mishnah. Brian, I'm sorry. I'll have to come back to you in a minute. I can't keep interrupting like that. The great work of the of his youth, the commentary on the Mishnah, is exactly that—a commentary on the Mishnah itself, going Mishnah by Mishnah, giving an explanation. But in a few key places, he has these lengthy excurses, almost freestanding works. One, a general introduction to the Mishnah, which we studied together, many of us, a few semesters ago, which is his history of Torah Sheba'al Peh, his history of the oral tradition, the history of rabbinic law. Another, which we also have studied parts of together, his commentary on the Perek Chelek, in Tractate Sanhedrin, where the Rambam lays out his principles of belief, as well as a few other important topics. And here, his introduction to the commentary on Masechet Avot, on what we call Pirkei Avot. Pirkei Avot, of course, is an ethical work. It's very much different than the other types of commentaries and tractates of the Mishnah. It deals with proper behavior and ethics and aphorisms of Chazal and the sages about the proper way in life and things of that nature. And the Rambam writes this lengthy introduction to his commentary on Avot called Shmona Prakim, the eight chapters, because it contained eight chapters. And it's his philosophy for, or his guidebook for, the perfection of what we call the personality. It's important not to be too anachronistic and read back in terminology that only comes about in the modern era, but essentially that's what the Rambam is discussing. His theory of personality formation and perfection, the perfection of the human soul, what he calls the soul. The object of perfection, of course, is for the Rambam nivuah, prophecy, that in order to refine oneself both ethically, morally, and intellectually, means to become at least potentially capable of receiving prophecy, of receiving divine inspiration and divine communication, and that one who is lacking in that type of human perfection is like a radio receiver who who's out of tune. I've used that metaphor a couple of times in the past. The idea of the radio receiver, or in the old days, the old televisions that we used to have, where you'd have to physically focus in the dial in order to receive the communication clearly. That's the kind of work that the Rambam is describing. We are now in the middle of that's again that's by way of review or by way of introduction for those of you that that were with us or that weren't with us. And again, you can look through the archives that I've posted a link to here in order to listen to any of the other sessions in the past, including the very, very first session we had together, where I gave a lengthier introduction to who the Rambam is and what his philosophy was and what he was doing and what his contribution to Jewish life, law, and thought is. Let me just again look over the list and the chats. Yes, so this is an introduction to the Rambam's commentary on Masechet Avot, on the tractate Avot, what we call Pirkei Avot, or what sometimes in English is translated as the Ethics of the Fathers, which is one of the tractates of the Mishnah that the Rambam is here using as a springboard to give you this philosophical theory. The Rambam had now, and this with this we'll end the review, the Rambam had laid forth his theory, well-known theory, of the golden mean, in which he says that all personality traits are really properly to be viewed as a spectrum, and to understand that it's all something like a fulcrum or like a seesaw. There are no good personality traits or bad personality traits. There are merely extremes of any personality trait, the extreme of any one thing being, by definition, with maybe possible exceptions, by definition, inherently bad and inherently dangerous. And we are, says the Rambam, the collective of all of our different personality traits. So the Rambam suggests that there might be a personality trait. He's going to now revisit a couple of examples where instead of being balanced, a person might have a misbalance. So imagine a seesaw where you had two children of disproportionate size. Pardon my limited art skills. So we've all seen seesaws like this. The large child is of course going to outweigh the small child, and going to tilt the teeter totter down in this direction because of the force of gravity that's exerted on one side. In order to maintain balance, we would have to move, we would have to shift the fulcrum, or we would have to move the lighter fellow closer to, no, I'm sorry, that's not correct. We'd have to move the heavier fellow closer to the center in order to counterbalance his greater weight. So it's the same thing with personality traits, says the Rambam. For the Rambam, it could be that although it's preferable to always go in the middle path, always to be in the middle, nevertheless, it's possible that because of the pull of gravity of any particular extreme. So for example, if we imagine a person that is caught between having excessive ego, or having extremely low self-esteem, both of which are the mirror images of each other and stand at the two extremes of a healthy self-image, which is not egotistical. So if somebody suffers from ego, from arrogance, it might be necessary for them to shift the center of gravity more towards shiflut ruach, more towards a sense of excessive modesty or low-spiritedness or a touch of lower self-esteem in order to counterbalance the pull in their personality of the arrogance. That's on one foot, the Rambam's theory of the middle path. We should always go towards the middle path unless we have to exercise a kind of corrective measure. That being said, the Rambam makes exceptions for two particularly negative personality traits, one being the one I just discussed, which is arrogance, ga'ava, and the other being ka'as, anger, because they're particularly dangerous. I'm not sure if this is Buddhist-like. Perhaps it's Jewish-like. The fact that anything in any one tradition could be compared to something in a different tradition doesn't necessarily create an equation. The Rambam now goes on to say, and here we'll return to our text. V'zot ha-Torah ha-Shlema, ha-Mishalemet otanu, kimo shehid aleha yoda'a, Torah Hashem tmima, machkimat peti. The Torah itself is shalem, tmima, perfect, full, shalem, shlema, from the root meaning whole or perfect, in the sense that it perfects us. It makes the foolish wise. It raises people up from the low. V'amnam kivna, let me just make the screen a bit larger. There you go. The beauty of Web Yeshiva, we can make everything visible. Va'amnam kivna shiyeh adam tiv'i holech b'derech ha'emtzait. That by nature it's one should direct himself to walk in this middle path. Yochal ma shemutur lo lechol b'shivui. A person should eat what he's allowed to eat with equanimity, with balance, a middle of the road. The Rambam had been discussing in our last session his extremely, extremely strong distaste for asceticism, for depriving yourself of worldly pleasures. And even though, when you look at the history of Jewish thought, there are or have been ascetic movements or trends in Jewish life, they have always been fringe movements. It has never been a mainstream philosophy of Judaism to adopt a rejection of physical pleasures, of earthly pleasures. This has not been our way. The Rambam says the proper path is to. No, Neturei Karta is in no way an ascetic movement. Neturei Karta is a political movement based on a theological hyphen political ideology, which is anti-Israel, anti-Zionism, but it's not in any way ascetic. The fact that amongst certain ultra-Orthodox communities in Israel and less so abroad, but also abroad, there might be a level of poverty should not be confused with asceticism. Asceticism, you know, a notion that we reject the pleasures of this world, eating, drinking, speaking, laughing, the physical comforts of marriage, of anything of that nature. Again, even though you can point to exceptions to this, the mainstream role of Judaism, and certainly the position of the Rambam, has not been ascetic. With certain, you know, that being said, neither is Judaism, a fraternity party, as we'll see in a moment. The Rambam says you should eat what you're permitted to eat with balance, all things in good measure. V'yishteh ma shemutar lo lishtot b'shivui, eating, drinking. V'yival mi shemutar lo livol b'shivui. Even here the Rambam is describing physical relations between man and wife. Again, in each thing it's important to note, b'mutar, we're allowed to eat, enjoy food, but it doesn't mean you can eat everything. Don't eat that ham sandwich. One is allowed to enjoy the physical intimacies of marriage, but within marriage, what goes on in general society all so often, and even within marriage, physical intimacy, because it's such a strong phenomena, such a powerful phenomena. It's limited. It's fenced in by all types of halachot that govern relations between the genders, because it's not a free for all. But within the context of what's permitted, the Rambam says that one should take enjoyment in food and drink, in physical intimacies between man and wife. V'yeshev medina b'tzedek v'yosher, lo sheyishkon b'marot v'harim. You should live in a society. And what's a society? A society is a place where there's things, where there are roads that are paved, and there are buildings, and there's supermarkets, and there's running water. I mean, I'm putting it all in the modern metaphor. You shouldn't live like a hermit in a cave or in the mountains or in the desert. Veloshi labash hasar v'hatzemer, and we don't believe that you should wear kind of ascetic garb, whatever these garments are that he's describing. They're clearly uncomfortable, scratchy, woolly clothing. One imagines pictures of medieval monks wearing those woolly, brown, scratchy clothing things. Medieval asceticism, Christian asceticism, certainly believe in this, but we do not. And you shouldn't depress your body. Kabbalah here, I'll emphasize what I've said before. When the Rambam uses the term Kabbalah, he is not talking about Jewish mysticism. He's not talking about Madonna. He's not talking about the Kabbalah Study Center. He's not talking about the Zohar or Tzvat or anything like that. For the Rambam, those are all notations of the term that come afterwards. For the Rambam, Kabbalah means the received tradition, the interpretive tradition of how the halacha is. Amar ben Nazir. So about the Nazir, the Rambam points out, you may be asking, what about the Nazir, the Nazirite? The Torah describes someone that takes a vow that he's going to limit certain pleasures of the world, including that he's not going to drink wine. He's going to take a vow not to drink wine. He's not going to cut his hair. There are examples, historic examples, of actual Nazirim. The Torah describes Nazirim. V'chiper alav ma'asher chata al ha'nefesh. So when a Nazir is done with his period of Nazirut, there's a whole tractate of Mishnah and Gemara called Nazir, which describes the halachot of what a nazir was and what he did, and etc. Generally speaking, a nazirut was a certain period of time. Somebody could take a vow for 30 days that they would be a nazir, and for those 30 days they could not drink wine, they wouldn't cut their hair, they could not become tamei, they couldn't come into contact with dead bodies. Is this still practice? In reality, no. Although there have been some modern exceptions to that, but generally speaking, the modern era, we don't have nazirim. The Rav Kook had a student. He was a Talmid Chaver, who was known as the Nazir. He was actually responsible for publishing some of Rav Kook's works after Rav Kook died. And the Nazir, he apparently was a modern day Nazir in the early 20th century, but his name was Harav David Cohen. But in reality, the Nazirut is not practiced today. But when a Nazir is done with his Nazirut, and the Torah presents Nazirut as a mitzvah, as something that somebody might aspire to, and in all cases, when the person is done with his Nazir, he has to do kapara for the sin that he committed against his own soul. He has to bring a korban chatat. He has to bring a sin offering, even though he just did this apparently positive thing in which he accepted upon himself to act with certain stringencies and to act with heightened level of holiness. But nevertheless, when he's done, he has to repair something that he's done. V'amru, so the Gemara asks, V'chi al mazeh nefesh chatazeh? What chait did he do? What sin did he commit that he has to now atone for? Al shemana atzmo min hayayin. Because he held himself back. He withheld wine from himself. Wine is, of course, a very powerful drink. It has the capacity to intoxicate you. And therefore, anything that has that kind of potential, even when you drink it, you know, a little sip of wine here or there doesn't get you drunk and doesn't make you lose yourself, but there's the potential for it. And the idea that you're going to try to elevate yourself above what you're allowed, and you're going to say, I'm not going to partake of that. Wine, of course, is also associated with great happiness. Wine is almost synonymous with happiness, with joy, with earthly pleasure, with physical pleasure. So you say, I'm going to be real frum. I'm not going to drink any wine. So the Torah says, there might even be something wrong with that. V'halo dvarim kal v'chomer, im mi shetzi'er atzmo min hayayin tzerech kapara, hametzer atzmo mikol davar alachat kama v'kama. So the Gemara says, the Rambam quotes, that if that's true about wine, that's true of everything else. The things that you're allowed to partake of, the Torah forbids plenty of things. Don't get me wrong. Read the Bible, you'll understand. The Torah forbids plenty of things. But the things that we are allowed to enjoy, which is, after all, the majority of things in the world, should be enjoyed with moderation, b'shivui, with everything always for the Rambam with moderation, the golden mean. But with moderation, you should enjoy them. And somebody that wants to limit his pleasure in the world beyond what the Torah itself limits, beyond what Chazal, for their reasons, may have set up safeguards around, that very act of being holier than thou is very suspect if it's motivated by this ascetic notion that you're going to limit. Now, of course, the Rambam's not talking about somebody, God forbid, has a drinking problem, has an alcoholic problem, who's addicted to alcohol, who's going to say, I'm never going to drink wine. I'm never going to drink alcohol. That's obviously something different. That's what the Rambam was talking about. That's what the Rambam was talking about here. For most people who don't have a drinking problem, Baruch Hashem, you can drink with moderation. It's okay to drink with them. On the contrary, you know, there are always these discussions about how come Jews historically, there are plenty of Jews, unfortunately, who have drinking problems. Plenty of Jews are alcoholics. I'm not saying that we're not. But historically speaking, the sociologists will tell you that amongst Jews, alcoholism was always lower than the national averages of the societies in which they lived. So why? So one theory, and it's only a theory, is that precisely because of this, because we didn't say it's forbidden to drink. On the contrary, drinking wine is part of our ritual. We drink wine every Friday night, every Shabbos morning at Kiddush. We drink four cups of wine at the Seder, on Yontif, on even in the shul that I grew up in. Even in the shul that I grew up in as a kid in New Jersey. So every morning after that, there were a lot of old men. Every morning somebody had a yahrzeit, and there was always a little l'chaim after davening. There was a bottle of old scotch. Everybody had, you know, about that much. All the old guys, they tossed down a little bit of I think it was wild turkey. I think that's bourbon, not scotch. A little something, and they went about their day. It was 6 o'clock in the morning. And even though drinking was always encouraged, drunkenness would have been run out of town. It would have been completely unacceptable. So this idea that we can sanctify ourselves with moderation while always rejecting the extreme is built into the system. This is a theory, but it's, I think it plays itself out, and we all might be able to relate to it. Let me just check the chat here. I know many people who make cholesterol offended. Okay, it's true. It's true. We can make fetishes out of everything. And there are all these different fads about what's good and what's bad. And of course, I think the smart, I'm not speaking medically, I'm not a doctor, of course. Perhaps there are doctors amongst us. But unless somebody has a particular problem, which of course, if you have a particular medical problem, so you have to do whatever the doctors tell you. That's one of the things the Rambam also teaches us. But for a normal, for a healthy person, this whole model is only talking about for, you know, somebody who's otherwise healthy, healthy physically, mentally, morally, emotionally, spiritually. If somebody's healthy, everything in moderation is the best rule of thumb. Are there any doctors with us online? Brian is a doctor. Okay, there you go. What kind of doctor are you? Very good. So do you concur with what I just said? Okay, you'll get back to mostly. Cholesterol's high. Okay, but everybody would agree. You don't think that it's... you don't think that cholesterol is not without any dangers, but in moderation, a healthy person should be able to participate in a normal diet. Let me just, before we move on, let me just pause for a second. Besides passing the mic to anyone that has any comments or questions, let me just look at who's with us. If I call out your name, do me a favor, just chat us in. Let us know where you are, because I don't recognize your name. Hillel Itzkowitz, Lillian Neves Mice. I hope I pronounced that right. Rachel Bracha Lawrence, Richard Plavin, Stacy Siepman. I think those people are all new to me. I don't know whether you're new just to our class or to Web Yeshiva in general. So just chat in, let us know where you're joining us from. Does anybody have any questions or comments on what we've discussed up until now? I'll be happy to pass you the mic. Ah, we have two Connecticut folk joining us tonight. Brian and Richard are... Richard, are you also new to Web Yeshiva? Welcome. Lillian, where are you joining us from? Josh Itzkowitz from Elizabeth, New Jersey. Huh. I grew up in Roselle, New Jersey, which is just one stop away on the parkway. In Brazil? How nice. Okay. I was once the NCSY chapter advisor in Elizabeth, New Jersey. That was a long time ago. I'm going to move on now. But Mesorot HaNevi'im, everyone else is also free. Please feel free, everyone else. Ben, Barbara, I know where you are, but perhaps other people don't. Everyone else is free to chat in, you know, who they are and where they are for the benefit of everyone else. And, of course, you're welcome to go online and see whatever part of the public profiles of your fellow students, whatever they've made public, generally where they are, etc. I encourage you to go online and fill in those profiles so we'll know more about you. Des Moines, Iowa. Wow, we're really branching out. Well, welcome to you all. So the Rambam goes on. B'mesorot nevi'enu matikei toratenu re'inum mechavnim el hashivui ve'el shmirat nefshoteim v'gufoteim ka'asher techayev ha'torah ve'yishiv Hashem yitaleh al yad nevi'o l'mi she'sha'al al tzom yom echad b'shana ha'im yatmid b'ze olo v'hu amru le'zachariah, etc., etc. I'll skip ahead, but the Rambam points out that it's true that there are fasts. We've all heard of Yom Kippur. We've all heard of the other fast days. It's not a contradiction. There, what he said in the previous paragraph is talking about normally, and then there are always exceptions to the norm. Sometimes we do have to, we do have to invest ourselves or the system with a bit of intensity. Yom Kippur is obviously a very intense experience, not just spiritually, but also physically. The idea that we're not going to eat, we're not going to wash, we're not going to wear leather sandals for 24, 25 hours, that's a kind of intense experience. But those are exceptions to the rule. It's true also that there are all types of other fast days, and there are people that have customs to fast. We're now in this period of, you know, some of Shovavim. There are people that fast during these weeks. I think I might have mentioned this in our last session. There are people that have accustomed to fast during these weeks, during when we're reading Sefer Shmot, to fast on Mondays, on Thursdays, for a half a day from sunrise to sunset, or at least until noon. But this does not, while a praiseworthy practice, this is not a mainstream practice. It's not something ever that the majority of people ever took on. Ashuv el kavanati. I'll just skip ahead a bit. The Rambam says, now I'll get back to the topic that I was discussing. This whole discussion of the asceticism. Ve'im yomru elu asher hidamu le'umot ma'anshei toratenu ho'il udvarai einam elaba shehem amnam yasu mash yasu mehatriach gufotehem umehefsek hanotehem al derech ahergel kochot aguf v'kedei shiyu notim el hakatze ha'eched ma'at kemo shebe'arnu b'zeh ha'perek shetzarech shiya adam kein. So people that want to build in all the time to err, to tip the scales, to tip the teeter-totter, so that built into their daily life, they're depriving themselves of the benefits of the world, the permitted benefits of the world. The Rambam says this is a mistake. Kemoshin Ivair. Vize Shahatora Amnam Asra Mash Asra Vitzifta Mashitzifta. The Torah forbade what it forbade, it commanded what it commanded. Mizotasiba Ritsoni, let me turn the page. Ritsoni Lomar Kedesha Nitrachek Min Hakatsea Chad Yoter El Sad Yoter El Al Sad HaHergel. She'esur hamachlot ha'asurot kulam. So the Torah already forbade plenty of things. There are all types of things we can't eat. There are all types of things that we can eat, but not whenever we want. There are things we can never eat. You can never eat pig. You can eat beef. Brian's point about cholesterol not being so much to worry about, I'll remind you of what he said. You're allowed to eat beef. You're allowed to eat chicken, but not all types of beef and chicken, only if it's been properly slaughtered, only if it underwent shchita, and then only if it's cooked in a kosher manner. And after you've had your hamburger or your chicken sandwich, you can't have ice cream, even though ice cream is pretty tasty, and it's permitted to have it. You have to wait a certain amount of time. You can't eat them together. So the things that are forbidden. The same is true for intimate relations, for sexual relations. The Torah forbids all types of interactions between men and women. And even within marriage, there are all types of requirements and obligations, ketubah, kiddushin, between husband and wife. Ve'im kol ze lo tiyeh muteret tamid, ela te'asar be'itut hanidah ve'aleida, ve'im ze siyugo chachamim lama'at ha'tashmish, hizhiru mizeh beyom, v'gam shebarnu b'sanhedrin, hine ze kulo amnam chiva Hashem, Chivo Hashem kedei she'nitrachek min hakatzeh hara merchak rav. And even within marriage, the framework of holiness and sanctity, I'm paraphrasing what the Rambam said, it all has to be kept within balance. It's not, life is not a free-for-all. We're allowed to enjoy in the pleasures of this world, but everything again within moderation. And now the Rambam gives you. An example. Brian asks a good question: Is this a recipe for the good life, or is the moral dimension for the Rambam? It's a clear moral dimension. It's a clear moral dimension. If you go back and review the last one or two sessions from the archive, you'll understand the greater framework in which he's making this argument. It has to do with the manner in which you can and really must, since you can, improve yourself, improve your personality, improve your soul, which is the task of our lives here in this world. Now the Rambam gives us an example. The example he gives you is of tzedakah. Kol ma sheba b'torah, minetinat ha-ma'asrot, v'haleket, v'ashicha, v'apeah, v'aperet, v'ololot. Tzedakah in the Torah was not always putting your hand in your pocket and giving a dollar bill to the person with his hand out. It was very much connected to the agriculture and to the tithes and the gifts that had to be given over from the produce of the land to people that were in need in various different ways. But we might, just summarize this as what we call today tzedakah. V'din hashmita v'yovel v'hatzedakah de mechzero amnam ze kulo karov lepazranut. Even though This approaches Pazranut. Pazranut is one of the midot, one of the character traits that the Rambam had previously described, in which a person would give away everything that he has. That's no good. It's no good to be stingy. But on the other side of the spectrum, it's no good to be a pazran, where you give away everything so that you yourself become dependent upon the charity of others. So charity, since all things being equal, most people, if they're going on that particular spectrum between being stingy, being greedy, being tight-fisted, and giving away everything, most people, I mean, think of anyone you know, not yourself, of course, but think of everybody else you know. Most people, if they're going to err on one side, it's going to be on the side of stinginess. That may be human nature. It may be certainly nature of those of us that have grown up in Western societies where capitalism is very deeply rooted in our identity, in our worldview. This idea that what I earned is mine, and you can go out and work for yourself. That's a problem. That attitude is a problem, since we're also commanded to care for those in our society who are less fortunate than us. So since that's the case, built into the Torah is this notion of tzedakah, that you have to give. So why does the Torah obligate us to give? And it should just be a moral free market. In a moral free market, what would happen? We would all err on the side of stinginess, and there'd be a lot of suffering in the world. But since the Torah is concerned that we live in a world in which people are involved in tikkun, in repairing the world, in helping other people, so built into the system is this notion that we're gonna weight the system. The Torah itself puts its finger on the scale in order to obligate us to do what probably we should do on our own, and that is to look out for the less fortunate. It's true that capitalism is not a moral philosophy. I didn't claim that it was a moral philosophy. It's an economic system, but it's an economic system which is not necessarily morally neutral. And one who grows up in a certain under this society versus that society is liable to imbibe certain cultural values that somebody that grows up in a different type of system is not liable to adopt, but would be influenced by the tenor of their own society. V'nitkarev l'ktze ha-pazranut kedei she-tikava banu ha-nidivut. And the Rambam said this is true for many mitzvot, that the mitzvot are there in order to imbue us with certain character traits. This is a theme of the Mor Nevuchim. It's the third section of the Mor Nevuchim. The Guide for the Perplexed is divided into three large sections. It's a major theme of the third section, perhaps the major theme of the third section, that the mitzvot, even though we perform the mitzvot because we are commanded, we say, Asher kedishanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu, we perform the mitzvot because we are commanded to perform mitzvot, and really for no other reason, yet we believe that the mitzvot themselves, engaging in the mitzvot, living a life, a committed life of being commanded, of fulfilling our obligations, that has an impact on our personality. It may not happen automatically. It actually definitely does not happen automatically. But if properly engaged, if with proper reflection, the performance of the mitzvot leaves an impact on molding our personality. The case of tzedakah being merely one example. And the Rambam says this is true of many other mitzvot. He gives a few other examples, which perhaps we'll come back to next week. And here the Rambam gets into this idea that our personality traits, the connection between our personality traits, how we act, how we behave, how we respond to certain situations, our ability to keep all those balls in the air. I think last semester we looked at that that great piece of wisdom, The Cat in the Hat. That picture of the cat bouncing on the ball, juggling the rake and the fish and the ball and the cake and everything else, that is a quick visual metaphor for the kind of work the Rambam is requiring of us. It's a great juggling act. It's a great balancing act to keep all of your personality traits. And again, this the idea, the visual metaphor of the scales or of the seesaw of any one personality trait, but of course we are the conglomerate of lots of different personality traits that all have this very complex interaction. You know, if one of my personality traits is really messed up, it's liable to have an effect on the whole system. It's going to be really hard to isolate my problem to that one personality trait. It's like a havdil. It's like a cancer that affects the whole system. That idea that how we act and how we respond is an outgrowth of is in dialogue with our performance of mitzvot is here the very central one. The Rambam in a few paragraphs will get to a very famous comment of his about Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, of course, Av HaNevi'im, the forefather of all prophets. Well, he made a mistake. What was his mistake in Parshat Chukat? It's not clear, but he's punished. God doesn't allow him to come into Eretz Yisrael. All of the commentators try to explain what Moshe did wrong. The Rambam gives his own explanation. It has to do with a defect, perhaps on the scale of things, a seemingly very minor defect in Moshe's personality and his ability to keep everything balanced. We'll get into that hopefully next time, and how that example reflects all of these theories that we've been discussing up until now. So again, I remind you, if you haven't yet, please log in for Sunday's very special Yom Iyun broadcast live from Shwiki. I can't even pretend to know how to pronounce it. Northern Poland. Next Tuesday, I'll be fresh back from Poland. I hope I will have thawed out, and I'll be able to give you a report on how that was. I put my email up in the chat box. Feel free to contact me. If you're new to the Shi'ur or if you're new to Web Yeshiva, I'd be very glad to make your acquaintance, you know, more one-on-one. You can also, my Skype name and my Gmail chat name is just simply Jeffrey Sachs, all one word. I'd be happy to speak with you. If you're here in Eretz Yisrael, or if you're going to be visiting Yerushalayim, I'd be happy to get together with you for a cup of coffee, as always. And if, because we kind of started in the middle of things and you're new to the course, I'd be happy to learn with you one-on-one to catch you up on anything that you missed. But again, you can go and get the archives of all of the previous shiurim to catch up if you'd like. So I'll stay online if anybody has any questions, and if not, we will continue next week.